We heard testimony, sworn testimony, that the Trump administration, through the CIA and with the CIA, had taken the same kind of criminal actions against Julian Assange while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy that the Nixon administration, with the help of CIA assets and former CIA officials, had done against me.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hello, everyone. Welcome, and thank you for joining us on The Tightrope. This is a place where we engage in tough and ever tougher issues and try to have a serious dialogue and keep our balance. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my dear friend and co-host, Dr. Cornel West. And every week, I try to check in with Dr. West and figure out what's going on in his mind, because whatever it is going to help us out. So this week, what is going on, Cornel, in your mind? What's troubling you? What's exciting you? What should we be thinking about?
Well, I think it's always a positive thing, my dear sister, to be in dialogue with somebody you have great joy and you have great inspiration. That's what I have once a week with you. And to be able to look for people around this country and around the world who exemplify a kind of courage and integrity that can inspire us to keep on keeping on in the middle of this moment in which the American empire, all the lies and crimes are coming back, a kind of blowback, as it were. And for us not to be in any way overwhelmed by the lies and overwhelmed by the crimes, but rather to fortify ourselves so that we can fructify. And by fructify, I mean engaging in the deeds, engaging in the truth-telling, engaging in the justice-seeking with others, always in community, out of a deep sense of solidarity with something bigger than us. And what we're able to do, it's really a blessing, is to have so many magnificent human beings of all colors and genders and sexual orientations and national identities to come on this show and to give us a chance to reflect on their truth-telling and on their justice-seeking.
Yeah, it's a great blessing. And it's been, you know, very healing and inspiring in such a terribly disappointing and potentially depression-producing time, you know.
That's
so to
truth.
Have just so many That's rich true. Examples of people with so much courage and who've just made amazing choices, you know, it helps a lot. And of course, hearing your, you know, you have always have such a fantastic big picture sense. You know, I feel like I'm an eagle soaring around when you're talking. I'm like, oh yeah, let me check out what's going on down there. And so I can sort of see the big picture. I'm usually hanging around, you know, with a spade and a shovel trying to play with the dirt. And you got me soaring above.
No, you got your ego perspective too in a powerful way.
But you have a whole cadre of amazing friends and colleagues, and one of them is our guest today. We have a very special, uber courageous guest today. And I would love to just turn it over to you, and although I normally do the introductions as part of our process, but I'm just really would be really honored if you would do the honors today, Cornel.
Oh, well, thank you. This is a very special role, and I thank you for that, but I feel good about it because I don't have a language to fully describe the depth of the courage and the scope of the fortitude of our dear brother, Daniel Ellsberg. There's simply nobody like him that I know. When the American Gibbon puts pen to paper and writes the story of the decline and fall of the American empire, Daniel Ellsberg's name will be there in terms of his willingness to disclose the lies and crimes of the American empire. Too many people view America as if it's simply a domestic affair, as if it doesn't have a foreign policy, as if it doesn't engage in wars, as if it doesn't have forms of militaristic activity around the world. And for so long, Americans had accepted what was told to them by presidents and Congress. It takes very, very special human beings, Some of them come from Chicago. Some come and have a part of a very rich Jewish American tradition. They might become Christian Scientists, but they still got that hesed from Hebrew scripture, spreading that love and justice to orphan and widow and fatherless and motherless. Some of them go to Harvard. Some of them become part for a moment of the establishment and begin to look around and see and say, my God, what I once believed is not true. The checkoff moment. What seemed to be the case, it didn't work out that way. Oh, it's like a checkoff story. I begin to see things differently, feel more broadly. That's what we have in this very special freedom fighter, Daniel Ellsberg. I could go on and on and on. We know him from the Pentagon Papers. We thank Beacon Press for their courage. Washington Post, New York Times, later on disclosing these lies. It was because of the courage of this dear brother, Daniel Ellsberg. Brother Daniel, I can go on and on. Thank you so much for being here. Almost 90 years. Look at that smile on your face. Strong as ever, mind sharp. What a blessing to have you here. And you're fresh from your testimony of our dear brother, Julian Assange.
That was a very eloquent introduction. I thank you for it, Brother Cornell.
I do. That's right. You are my brother now.
It's an honor. My mind is boggled at this moment because as of yesterday, in following the case of Julian Assange in London, I testified there a little over a week ago through Zoom. And we heard testimony, sworn testimony, that the Trump administration through the CIA and with the CIA had taken the same kind of criminal actions against Julian Assange while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy that the Nixon administration, with the help of CIA assets and former CIA officials, had done against me. And the chance in my case that that would be revealed was pretty low. People keep those secrets. But in this case, the secrets did come out toward the end of my trial. And the effect of that was that the judge, having heard testimony day after day of what we're hearing right now in the Julian Assange case in London, said finally, having not ended the trial when the word came out that he had been offered the head of the FBI ship, something that he had wanted since he was a boy to replace J. Edgar Hoover, who had died now and be his substitute. He was offered that job during my trial by Nixon at San Clemente, clearly on the implication that if my trial ended fast and before the word came out of the criminal actions that had been taken against me, which actually came out a little bit after he got that offer. It was clearly in order to influence him not to bring it out in court that people working for the White House had entered, burglarized the office of my former psychoanalyst. It came out later in order to get information to blackmail me into silence. Now, this administration has been as desperate, that's the word used by one of the witnesses who was working for them, as desperate to silence Julian Assange, not just to prosecute him and punish him for what he had revealed, but to shut him up as they were to shut me up. Because although, going back again 50 years, although the Pentagon Papers had all come out by that time, and I was on trial facing 12 felony counts for a possible 115-year sentence, Julian is now facing 175-year possible sentence, so inflation there. But same kind of charges that I was the first to be charged with. Okay, but their problem was they didn't want me to tell what Nixon had been doing, and the Pentagon Papers had ended in 1968 before Nixon came into office. Nixon feared that I knew his nuclear threats against North Vietnam, his intentions and plans for escalating as he did, except for the nuclear part, which he was prevented from doing, by the way, by the largest demonstrations till that time in American history, the moratorium demonstrations in 1969. They kept him from carrying out his nuclear threats, but he didn't give up on those threats. He continued to make them. He was afraid I would put out documents on them, and he had to shut me up, just as they want to shut up Julian Assange from whatever else he may know about their inner workings or their crimes. Okay, so how to do that? In my case, They wanted information they could blackmail me with on my family or my children, my wife, as well as on me. That came out. They were wiretapping people that I was talking to and denying it, lying about it for a matter of over a year, as a matter of fact. At one point, they sent a dozen Cuban assets from the Bay of Pigs up to incapacitate Daniel Ellsberg totally. Those were the words. On the steps of the Capitol at a demonstration, May 3rd, 1972. Remember, my trial started, my indictment was in June of 1971. The trial went on in two slots, basically, till 73. So in the middle of it, these people were sent up to incapacitate me totally. And when I asked the prosecutor, special prosecutor, William Merrill, what does that mean? Kill me? He said, the words were to incapacitate you totally. He said, but you have to understand, these guys don't use the word kill. We heard, you know, neutralize, terminate with extreme prejudice. What we just learned yesterday was that the people who were conducting the surveillance in a Spanish firm, but inside the Ecuadorian embassy, were having discussions with CIA about poisoning Julian Assange, killing him, shut him up, or kidnapping him from the embassy. And you know that he was under constant surveillance by, you probably walked past police in the hallway, as I did, and there were police across the street watching his windows. We now know those police across the street had a laser on a beam on his windows to catch what he was saying. We heard all kinds of details. For instance, they made them put a sticker on the windows at one point, and the person who was testifying said, why was that necessary? And it turned out that Julian had a white noise machine to frustrate intelligence because he knew these, the ropes on this stuff, and the sticker would stop the window from vibrating so that they could hear the conversations. They had microphones in his bathroom underneath a fire extinguisher and in a socket because, fearing surveillance in his paranoid ways, we've all heard about Julian Assange, he thought he might be surveilled. He was having discussions with his lawyers in the bathroom, so they put microphones in the bathroom and got everything on video and sound all the time. Now, in my case, as I say, day after day, once people started talking, there were revelations of this sort. A CIA profile that had been done on me, for example, to see how I could be manipulated by a psychiatrist or somehow defamed. Everything at that time, illegal. Unfortunately, since 2001, after 9/11, all of the things that were done against me by Nixon, which led to the ending of my trial, the dropping of charges, and much more importantly, put Nixon on impeachment proceedings. They were major charges against Nixon in his impeachment proceedings, which led to his resignation. All those things are now legalized by the Patriot Act, by other acts, CIA being used for police functions, burglaries, warrantless wiretaps, as I was under her. They haven't, strictly speaking, said that killing Americans, Julian is Australian as it happens, even though he's being extradited under the Espionage Act to America. But I was an American. And killing of Americans at that time was regarded as, Congress hasn't yet legislated that that's legal. But President Obama, Barack Obama, was meeting, I think, Tuesday mornings they came out. He didn't object, by the way, to this coming out because it showed what a tough, straightforward manager of the empire he was. And it showed he was selecting American, people, including American citizens, American-born citizens, for assassination by drones. Anwar al-Awlaki, an American-born citizen. And I think within 2 weeks later, his 16-year-old son, who was looking for his father, was assassinated by a drone as a result of this same program. So I had to conclude, even that didn't lead to any objection from Congress when it came out. So the incapacitation of me is now, in this century, something that can happen to Americans. No due process, no whatever. When Ed Snowden, with the help of Julian Assange, was fleeing, you know, extradition from Hong Kong or kidnapping, I had no doubt if they could assassinate Ed Snowden, they would have done that before he got to Russia, which has no extradition treaty there. And when I said that, people said, Ellsberg, off the wall here. He's really, what is he saying? That's not what Americans do. And I had to say, you're talking to an American who had a dozen CIA assets set out to assassinate me or incapacitate me. Strictly speaking, I wasn't sure that the prosecutor, William Merrill, was right when he thought that they were definitely going to assassinate me. I was putting out the word that they were going to mine Haiphong, which they did, and renew the bombing of North Vietnam on a massive scale. And I knew they'd meet nuclear threats. But I didn't have the documents that Nixon feared I had. I think what they wanted me to do was shut up till the mining occurred. By the way, the attempt on me was May 3rd. The mining was May 8th. And I think for a week or two, they wanted Daniel Ellsberg quiet till the mining and every, and whatever else they had in mind was a fait accompli. So one of the Cubans, Bernard Macho Barker, who was later caught in the Watergate, said to my friend Lloyd Shearer of Parade magazine, my job was to break both his legs. But I don't think that, and that wouldn't have shut me up. No, I think something had to be done to my jaw a little more, at the very least. Anyway, that's what I learned about my country almost 50 years ago. Now we learn yesterday, that Julian Assange, this Australian, and now Ecuadorian, being extradited to America to face the American Espionage Act, and that's what they're trying to do, was subject to discussions of poisoning him or kidnapping him. And eventually, he was effectively kidnapped with the acquiescence of the new Ecuadorian prime minister, not the one who had given him asylum initially. Mm-hmm. So we've all seen the pictures of him being carried out and put in solitary for the last year and a half. What I'm doing, in other words, is reliving what, for me, I have to say was the best part of my 2 years under indictment, because every day these revelations of government criminality, which obviously had the possibility of bringing down a president who was determined to keep the war going in Vietnam. I hadn't foreseen that anything I could do might possibly have that effect, but it did. These are charges against the Trump administration that have no question are high crimes and misdemeanors. They are impeachable offenses. He doesn't have to have ordered it in every detail. It was done under his watch with his approval over a long period of time, by the way, from the first month he came in. This surveillance was accentuated and gone. That should certainly end this trial, which should never have begun, this indictment. It certainly should wipe it out. It certainly should keep the British from extraditing him to a country that did this to him in Ecuador and planned to do more. The judge says we won't hear her judgment until January 4th. 3 more months for Julian in a COVID-inflicted terrorist prison, where he's subject to virtually total isolation, 23 hours a day in an isolation cell. 3 more months of that, there shouldn't be another day of it. Okay, that's what's on my mind today.
Oh, no, indeed. No, that's, we need to hear that. I'm blessed to be one of the witnesses as well. I've made a deposition to Brother Julian's lawyers and would be open to being called just in order to bear witness to this resistance against the lies and the crimes and his defense, the defense of him in terms of both his rights, let alone his humanity, but his rights and his liberties. But what is so frustrating, my dear brother, is the kind of bipartisan consensus when it comes to military-industrial complex, when it comes to the military budget, when it comes to AFRICOM's expansion in Africa, when it comes to what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in Latin America, what's going on in Asia. How do we break through so that these issues are not taboo issues, so people can see the degree to which these militaristic operations without any accountability or answerability are built into the bipartisanship of both liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, because you have seen it in its raw form for so long and remained a truth teller all the way through?
I don't think the American people in general have a sense that they live in an empire. They don't have that concept in mind. They read about regime change in a way that's now been normalized. We read it in the paper every other day. Should we change this regime, that regime? How should we do it? Covertly by assassination, by paramilitary, by perhaps an invasion, as in Iraq, to get rid of Saddam, as George W. Bush still boasts of the fact that he ridded the world and he rid Iraq of Saddam by invading Iraq. A clear-cut crime of aggression, a clear-cut crime against the peace for which Japanese generals were hanged and German generals were hanged under a court that included Americans. And with a justice of the Supreme Court, Jackson, who said, it will be a mockery of justice if we don't apply these same rules to ourselves. Well, I was very admiring of that process at the point. I was proud to be part of a country that believed in the rule of law and was ready to sacrifice lives and take risks and whatnot to go against aggression. I volunteered for the Marines during the Korean crisis, believing we'd been right to oppose what I then clearly was aggression by North Korea at that point. So seen by the UN, in which it so happened that the Russians were not sitting in the Security Council at that time. But anyway, I was glad to be in a country that was ready to oppose aggression. It did not occur to me that what we saw less clearly in Vietnam, where we pretended to be backing what was in fact a totally American puppet government, an American regime, essentially. But I didn't see it as such. Iraq, no disguise on that one. That was clear-cut crime of aggression on that. You know, I was ashamed as an American the other night watching the debate and hoping that other countries that aspire to democracy were not watching, because it was embarrassing, it was shameful. But nothing we saw in that, the bullying and the lying and all that, which we've experienced for several years now, actually even compares with things we've seen in the past and perhaps in our future, like Iraq, where more than a million people have been killed. Several million have been forced as refugees. The Elias report says, I said this in court, by the way, for Assange, they were worried about informants that he might have revealed. Now, it's been testified by the government officials, there is not evidence of one single person being harmed. As was that, if they had it, be sure you'd see every evidence of that. No, they said, we have no evidence, but he might have harmed, he risked them. This from a government that started with the invasion of Iraq, first of Afghanistan and then Iraq, with the creation of 37 million refugees in the Middle East. That's a report just a month ago. And this government pretends to be so concerned that Julian Assange might have risked a handful. And they were willing to, which he didn't. Nobody was harmed. But they were threatening the newspapers and everything, you'll have blood on your hands. This from people who are stepped in blood up to their eyeballs. And that is a shame for this country. So coming back to your question, Granado, first step is to discover that crimes of the sort we've heard about today and yesterday from Consortium News, Joe Loria, from Kevin Gastola on a blog or something, and from an AP dispatch, crimes, you know, CIA trying to kill somebody, surveilling someone, you know, there hasn't been one word in the New York Times or the Washington Post. These are not crimes by the Australian government or the British government. They are crimes by the American government. Amazing. Exactly like my court. And let me tell you, when that stuff came out in my courtroom, it was like a scene from the movie First Front Page, if you've ever seen it. All the report in the back of the room had been lying there dozing and bored by the endless 4.5 months of testimony they'd heard about these boring documents of the Pentagon Papers. And when they heard about this burglary from the White House, They jumped up and rushed for the payphones at last Watergate meets the Pentagon Papers case. They were so frustrated. They'd been sitting in Los Angeles while Watergate was going on. And all of a sudden, Watergate had penetrated our courtroom. And it did, in fact, lead to the impeachment proceedings against a president. We've just heard this now, yesterday and today. Not a word. There's an AP story and a note. Not yet in any other newspaper except for AP. Wow. These events, which are ignored now, right at the time when they're happening, are never connected for the public as our policy, as our practice. It's what we do. Remember when McCain said that when he was in prison being tortured in Hanoi, Senator McCain, when he was a prisoner of war, he said they were torturing him. And he said, what kept me going was the thought that my country wouldn't do this. Americans don't torture. And that's what Obama said and others said. Americans, that's not us. That's not who we are. We don't torture. They were both wrong. Obama was wrong. McCain was wrong. It is what we did. It is what we do. It's what, by the way, Chelsea Manning revealed and had been done under Obama. Why do you think they're so anxious? Why they kept Chelsea Manning for 7.5 years in prison? Because she had revealed crimes in Iraq that could be traced directly to the White House. Turning people over for torture to the Iraqi army to be tortured is as clear-cut a crime as torturing them ourselves, which had been done under George W. Bush on a massive scale, in which Barack Obama had decriminalized by refusing to prosecute. Because it didn't serve his relations with CIA to make them mad at him by prosecuting any of them for the crimes they'd done. And in short, what we elect, and it's what we're electing now, is a manager of the empire. That's who we're given by the nominees of the two major parties. And there can be a great difference. It's essential that Donald Trump not continue to be the manager of the empire. But in the longer run, to answer your question, it's essential that we stop managing an empire by these covert means and these invasion means and whatnot, and be able to elect someone. Tulsi Gabbard, you know, was the one of 20 people up there who kept saying, I'm against regime change war. Bernie Sanders talked about cutting the defense budget by 10%. Barbara Lee was much more on the right track, same month. Cut it by 50%. That's a couple $100 billion. You can do a lot with that. You can do quite a bit even with the 10% that Bernie wanted to cut. But that doesn't get you the nomination of our party. And we are a two-party system.
In light of all of the insights you've just shared with us about the depths of the corruption, the violence, the regime-sanctioned assassination attempts or plans for you and others, and the fact that you think now all of the things that were considered illegal enough to prevent you from being harmed are now legal. Given all that you've said, if you knew then what you know now, would you have still done the same thing? Would you still have revealed the information in the Pentagon Papers, given what you know now?
Of course. Of course. A war's worth of lives were at stake, as they were in the mind of Chelsea Manning. And in Snowden's case, the Constitution was at stake. The total violation of the Fourth Amendment, total abolition of privacy here, surveillance of everyone, and not only in America, surveillance of everyone in the world. Snowden was against that. By the way, Snowden, having been an intelligence officer, was not against targeted surveillance, not against an intelligence program. As a matter of fact, he said, I'm not against even tapping Merkel, which he was accused of, which he said, by the way, was not his. He said, that's targeted intelligence. He was against tapping every German, which is what we do, essentially, everybody in the world. So, and what an empire does, if it can, you know, any of them, we're not the only one.
When we see that's not the case, when we know that those kinds of rules of law and ethical responses are not going to be honored. And in fact, the law has been changed to prevent any opportunity for people to be held accountable in the same way. It raises the question of what can we expect? So I guess, you know, going forward now, we think about whistleblowers today. What might motivate them, right, given that they can see that there's no law to protect them potentially?
It's a good question, and not one that haven't received very much to. So let me address that. President Trump has been threatening for years now to find a provocation or not to attack Iran. Not necessarily to invade it, although that would come eventually when the simple bombing didn't accomplish what he wanted. Possibly use nuclear weapons. Had Richard Cheney, Dick Cheney, ordered the JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, to prepare back in 2006, 14 years ago. I think the possibility of a war, even in the next month, when he is so desperately trying to change the conversation, to draw people to his support some way or other. I've thought all year that a war was a very strong possibility, and Iran could be that possibility. And I would say that anyone who had the access that I had in 1964 about plans to bomb and invade Vietnam, which I did not give to the Congress or anybody, but I worked on them. Anybody who has that kind of access to plans for that about Iran, and I am certain those plans exist in detail. We've been told by Bolton, we've been told by Mattis, we've been told by others that the president called for those plans to be ready to be done on a moment's notice. They should consider, at whatever cost to themselves, making those plans and possible provocations and excuses and lies and false flag incidents public, whatever happens to them. Now, what is that asking of someone? Well, it's certainly not asking more of them than we ask of hundreds of thousands in the last 20 years of our soldiers to do, and which they do. I've been in combat as a civilian, it so happens, but I walk with soldiers using my training, prior training as Marine infantryman, company commander, platoon leader. I saw a lot of courage. And every American has seen that. And by the way, it's on both sides. That's a little secret. But the courage is very available. You can train young men, especially, and young women now, to risk their lives or to give their lives for the cause, for the mission, for their comrades. You can train them pretty easily and get them recruited for that and everything. But how about courage in civilian life to risk your career, your clearance, your access, your marriage, any risk of that? Very hard, it turns out. Very hard to get people to do that. So I was fortunate enough to meet young Americans at a time when for years, a couple of years, I had thought the war should be ended and was wrong for the United States. And I was using inside methods to do that. I was talking to cabinet members, talking to press, talking to Congress. All is inside, nothing which risked my job particularly. But I met young men who were on their way to prison for nonviolent draft resistance. And without them, it never would have occurred to me what they did put into my head. Now what can I do to shorten this war now that I'm ready to go to prison? When it comes to whistleblowers, they now do have to go to prison or risk prison. But risking your career, they don't do it. They don't feel the challenge to do it. They don't feel the need to do it. So I thought, well, okay, I'm on trial facing a 115-year sentence. That's meant to slow people down from following that example. That's understandable. And of course, it did do that. But I thought somebody may notice that it's generally regarded that that revelation did have an effect on shortening a war. It was effective, and it by a miracle, like Julian is facing right now, same miracle, I didn't go to prison. So I thought, okay, I waited for others to do what I'd done, which was to release a lot of information, which will show a pattern of behavior, of atrocity, of torture, of lying, that show that it's a policy. It's not just, by the way, what Joe Biden said the other day about the police. It's not just a few bad apples. That's not the problem. And it's a policy here, and a practice, and a culture. Okay, so it takes a lot of information to do that. Or videos like George Floyd, or like Rodney King, or like collateral murder that Chelsea Manning gave to Julian Assange. showing people, civilians, including Reuters journalists, being shot down by laughing people in a hill. Take something like that to make the point. And I waited for it. I waited until that video. That was 39 years. That came 39 years. So I thought, okay, with Chelsea Manning brought out that stuff, thanks to Julian Assange and went to the newspapers, I thought, good, at last. And then I heard Chelsea's record of saying to her informant, unfortunately, who informed on her, she was then Bradley Manning, she said, I'm ready to go to prison for life or be executed. She ended up facing prison for life and the possibility of capital punishment. She said, I'm ready to do that, to get this up. And I thought, that's what I felt. I haven't heard anybody else say that for 39 years. Well, then just 3 years later, that was 2010. In 2013, Ed Snowden said the same thing, and did the same thing, put out even more material in the digital age than I could possibly have put out in the Xerox age. And he put it out, and he said, there are things worth dying for. Well, that's the answer to your question. Yes. Yeah. Whatever they do to Snowden, whatever they do in the end, and I think he'll be at risk of his life for the rest of his life, wherever he is, and whatever they do to Chelsea in the future, whatever they do to Assange, there will be people like them who will take that risk. But not enough to keep us out of these wars, not enough to change our country from being an empire. And that's what has to happen. We have to have certainly not people like Donald Trump. I mean, that's what's so ashamed, the sense of dismay and embarrassment and horror that I live in a country that elected Donald Trump president and could do it again. That's terrible. Now, Biden, actually, he's not a person to end the empire, nor is Kamala Harris. But we have to get Donald Trump out of that. We have to elect Biden. Anybody who discourages anyone for working for the election of Biden and Harris, I think, is whether to say don't vote, Tweedledum, Tweedledee, it's all the same stuff, not worth it, or vote for Green Party, frankly, good platform. But that can help elect Donald Trump, as he knows. So that's terrible. I can't respect any such person who gives such a message. But it's also true there has to be a lot more change than we're seeing now, but that will not come through 4 more years of Donald Trump.
No, we wholeheartedly agree there. We want an anti-fascist vote to make sure America doesn't walk down the road to fascism. But I want to go back to Sister Tricia's question. It's just such a crucial one. But I do want to just throw out some names for you. I'm thinking of Randy Kaler. I'm thinking of Iqbal Ahmad, who was my dear brother. I used to spend time with him in the living room of Edward Said's house. I'm thinking of Leonard Boudin and Rabinowitz and Charles Nesson, who's still here at Harvard Law. Those who came as supportive forces, a wind at your back, so that you were not so thoroughly isolated that you would feel as if there's nobody there. I mean, Brother Chris Hedges and I used to drive to the Manny trial in Maryland, to sit there right on the front row and let Manny know that somebody cares, concerned, and wants to reveal these crimes and lies. And he, at that time, Manny, but he's Chelsea, now, that she was willing to die. Same was true with Snowden. Same is true with Drake. We can go on and on, all these different examples of people who have been brought in under the Espionage Act. But whether in our day people feel as if, well, the system just seems to be beyond reform. I mean, what do you say to them, given the unbelievable struggle that you have waged, and yet here we're still locked into a discourse where we can't even have the journalists tell the truth about the American empire. Journalists tell the truth about the crimes and lies. They are collaborationists. They so easily want to accommodate themselves. Can the system be reformed? How do we make a case to the younger generation that we want courageous and visionary citizens like yourself?
We have a chance in the next 30 days that a lot of countries don't have effectively. We all know, and this is a shame of America, that Donald Trump can get elected again. It is not impossible. It is not certain, even though he's behind now. It is not certain that with all that's come out, that he will not be elected. But it's very far from certain that he will be elected. We have a chance. Let's say progressives, and we're a minority in this country. I'd like to know, in a sense, what a good figure would be, but it's certainly a minority. There are, by the way, 90, maybe 97 in the Progressive Caucus in the House, all Democrats, zero Republican progressives. So people say there's no difference between the parties here, are just talking through their hat that's ideological. We shouldn't just be 97. 297 would be a lot better. We're not going to get that many in November, but we have to remove a lot of Republican senators as well as removing Donald Trump. And we have a chance to do that. And here's where progressives, especially on the presidential part, can make a real difference right now. And young people. I was in a panel the other night with very great activists. And when I look at them at 89, I had to ask them, can any of you vote? Are you old enough to vote? They were, actually. And they were saying, you know, vote for one of them from the Democratic Socialists of America, who said that many of her colleagues in the DSA, Democratic Socialists, are working night and day, as she is, to remove Donald Trump and to get Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in there. I did have to ask her. So the majority, she said, of people in DSA actually felt that way. And I said, how is it that the organization doesn't find itself able to say that people should vote for Joe Biden? She said, well, he's a capitalist. You know, I said, but the majority would prefer to have Biden than Trump? She said, yes. Doesn't the organization have Democratic in the title? Democratic Socialists here? How do we understand this? I can't respect, she asked me to join, by the way, but I had to say, I can't respect an organization that can't find itself able to tell people as an organization in this crisis, please, phone bank, get people to the polls, tell them the importance of getting Donald Trump out of there. No, it leaves it to their members to do that. What, in cover, undercover with pseudonyms? What? You know, I'm singling them out, but I could say the same thing about the Greens. The Green platform is great, better than the Democratic platform, yes, but they can have an effect which Trump is counting on. And I'm talking about progressives in general. Trump said recently something right. It happens for everybody, even Trump.
Twice a day, a clock is right.
What he said was, what got me in office was people who had voted for Obama and didn't vote Democrat in 2016. And he said, either they didn't vote or they voted for another party, which is true. You know, 26% of Bernie voters in 2016 did not vote for Hillary Clinton. Well, they hated Hillary Clinton, fine. But that's what Trump counted on correctly. 12% of them, by the way, that is half of them, voted for Trump. That's fairly amazing. But a lot of them didn't vote or not. Now, here's the point. What Trump said was, that was almost as good as voting for me. And he's right. Not quite as good, maybe half as good. But it's like voting for him. That is intolerable this time, to pass up an opportunity that we have in November to get him out and to get the Senate to flip. It won't be a progressive Senate. With how many Democrats? You know, the progressives will be a minority. Okay, there's two issues. We haven't even gotten into this, but I say there's two issues that are absolutely crucial right now. And Cornell, you mentioned one of them. You mentioned the word fascism. That has been, as you know, and I know, an epithet, a rhetorical thing since the war. It's saying, oh, you're just, you know, exaggerating or whatever. I don't think it's an exaggeration now. I saw a column the other day that was written in 2016 with the headline, is Donald Trump a fascist? This is 2016. So the writer guessed five experts on fascism, and they all said in 2016, no, he's a right-wing populist, but he's not a fascist. And they went down five criteria of fascism, and they said, you know, an emphasis on violence, on militarism, and they had a number of things. And I was reading this just the other day and saying, wait a minute, he checks out all of those now. We heard in the other call for violence to what can be called brown shirts, like in Hitler's case, the SA. They could be called black shirts. Their uniform, by the way, the Proud Boys, is a polo shirt that's black with some yellow on it. Fred Perry it's an international firm. They don't want to sell it in America anymore because it's used for a paramilitary militia of some kind here. Okay, so I don't think Donald Trump is a proto-fascist. I think he is a would-be fascist, a wannabe fascist. He will be a fascist. He will be no mistake, I think, if we get him in office for another 4 years. He won't be arguing about that. So democracy is at stake on the one hand.
Absolutely.
And on the other hand, countries have faced that. And some have surmounted it, and some have fallen into it. Some have gotten over it in the last century. But no generation has ever faced what we're facing on climate right now. And four more years of Donald Trump means, with the help of the Republican Party in the Senate, means four more out of the 10 where we're supposed by the Paris Accords to reduce emissions by 50%, reduce emissions. Now, emissions are going up everywhere, not only the U.S. We can't afford that. They've got to be zero by 2050. So in the rest of this 10 years we have left to 2050, four more years of Trump means maximum increase of emissions and maximum increase in the rate of increasing. Acceleration. He's removing not only the Paris Accords, which were inadequate. He has not only gotten out of that, which Biden, of course, has promised to go in back into, rightly, the day he gets in, but he's taking out every regulation that puts any restraint on coal firing, on toxics in the environment, on cars, whatever. And he's going and boasting for every bit of fracking, every bit of offshore drilling, Arctic drilling, everything else.
Yeah.
He is maximizing the emissions in atmosphere. That is a crime against humanity.
Absolutely.
We have a little bit more time, just time for maybe one more question. Cornell, did you have a question? I got several over here I'm thinking about.
Go right ahead. We could talk to Brother Ellsberg for all night, though. I mean,
I know.
Such a powerful
I know,
voice.
I know. Whew, it's heavy, heavy. I wanted to sort of think about these young people that you talked about, not just the Democratic Socialists who, you know, are trying to get Biden in undercover, but youth in general. In terms of what you see, given the wisdom that you have about being a whistleblower and all the sacrifice and all the difficulty and suffering. I mean, that's a long, long time to be under a lot of surveillance and knowing that a government's trying to crush you. So there's a lot of risk there. Do you have any advice for this generation of young people about how they should approach being a whistleblower? It's a general question, but I was thinking in particular of the woman, Dawn Wooten, who blew the whistle on the unconsented hysterectomies in that private ICE detention center recently. You know, again, I think given all we know about the new technologies, about how to use extreme, what's that CIA phrase? Terminate with extreme, whatever the phrase is, basically kill you without saying so. What advice would you give these potential, very courageous people who are potentially want to blow the whistle? What just as a way, as a kind of closing thing for them, what would you tell them to most be concerned about to help them along this journey? Because I think we need a lot more people as courageous as you to do what you've done.
I would tell them the truth. I would not tell them that telling the truth, no matter what it is, guarantees that people will act on it, or that enough people will act on it, or the change will come. As a matter of fact, there's very far from a guarantee in many cases, but it is possible. as is shown in every one of these cases we're talking about. For example, you mentioned the ICE case right now and the forced sterilizations, for example, that have been going on. Is there a guarantee that will stop? No. My impression is, though, that it actually we're seeing some change, at least formally, right away. Is there a possibility of change? Absolutely. The likelihood, if you're known as a whistleblower, if you're not anonymous, the likelihood of retaliation and of recrimination and a bit of losing benefits of various kinds is very high, actually. It's a whole range of things, but it's real. It's not. It's something important. I wouldn't even think of doing that in major ways unless the stakes were very high. But the stakes are often very high, and we're living in a time now where every day shows us more in the fire problems, which our president is rushing off, basically. You know, when they asked him, what does he believe? This was the other night in the debate. What does he believe about climate science? And he talked about clean air. Well, that's a problem. I'm talking to in a basement here where, in fact, the air was so bad recently that we were warned not to go outside. As a matter of fact, there's a red alert on in Berkeley right now because of the fires in Northern California. Now, are the fires due? This is what they were really asking about in climate. Was that bad air and the fire, which made the sky orange, by the way, for one day? That was a bizarre science fiction kind of sight outside these windows that I'm looking at. Okay, what caused that? What can we do about it? He said, get the vegetation off the floors of the forest. What the governor should be doing, although as a matter of fact, the Forest Service, a lot of it is federal, but he said, that's the problem. No, that's a lie. That's a big lie. But what is it a lie about? It's a lie about, don't ask me to do things that will lower the profits of the oil companies or the coal companies. You ain't gonna get it from me. I'm not gonna do it. As I said, that's what I described earlier as a crime against humanity. It's not just against California. He was not able to say that the fires in California, what everybody else knows, are affected by the dryness and the drought and the heat of this climate, which he is working at raising right. The heat as much as possible. So I come back to your question, revealing these truths and getting the media to focus on them, as sometimes they do, as Congress to focus on it, sometimes they do. Not Republicans, by the way. I mean, we're facing something really bizarre there. Remember, the impeachment proceedings against Nixon included many Republicans. That's inconceivable now, but that's a change. We can change that. So these young people who are into electoral politics are also right that it's not enough, that there is risk-taking, truth-telling, and there is movement building, and there is everything that was needed to shorten the Vietnam War, rallies, demonstrations, civil disobedience, which Chris Hedges emphasizes very much, rightly, except that you also need the electoral work. Also, you need all of it. Their future depends on everybody's. And you know, if you ask, how can people vote for Trump? Well, some people have a good reason in the short run. They make a lot of money from it. Rich people have benefited enormously from it. He promised it to them, and they're getting it. I think Biden said $300 billion in the last few months or something. So he's delivered for them. What exactly it means to the lifestyle or even the power or anything else of somebody who has $10 billion to have $2 billion more, or, you know, what is it, the Amazon guy has enormously more than that, and now he has even more. I don't understand that. But at any rate, he's happy to have it. What about their children, though, and the world they're living to them? I'll make a little guess on that. How can they do this to their grandchildren, to everybody else? Two things. I don't think people care as much about their grandchildren as we would like to think they did. And for the rich people, I have another emphasis. I think they'll think they get away with it. They'll be in a bubble somewhere, in a ventilated bubble in New Zealand or something, and
they'll populate another planet.
Yeah, some of them are working on that. Some are working to be resuscitated themselves in some century when the heat has passed. That may be 1,000 years. So the young people I think, are people who can, who are prepared, as they were in the 60s, to try to build a better world. There was a movement then. We talked about the movement. We didn't talk about so much then about the civil rights movement that started it, really, let alone, or the anti-war movement, or the what came to be gay rights, what came to be women's rights. My wife is sitting next to me here. When you asked what the strain of this was, she was telling me that she was worried for my life when I went in front of big meetings. And I said, no, I didn't believe that. I'd worked for the government. I knew we killed foreigners. I knew we tortured foreigners. I knew that. I've been in the Foreign Service. I was in Vietnam. I talked to a guy whose car had been blown up by what Dr. Don, his name was, in Vietnam. He came to me, he was shaking because he'd been blown out of his car, hadn't been killed by what he knew was a CIA bomb, because he was blowing the whistle on our puppets over there. I thought, okay, they do that to Dr. Don, but they don't do that to Dr. Dan here. I've never made that pun before, but they don't do it to Americans. I was wrong.
Well, we could go on and on, brother, but we just thank you for your life, your witness, your sacrifice, your struggle, and your time with us. You are an inspiration beyond words in so many different ways and on so many different levels.
Well, Cornell, you have been, Tricia, it's my first time I've met you and I appreciate it. But Cornell, you've been a hero of mine for a long time. So for what you've done, and I'm very well aware of the honor it is to be on a program with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dan.
We salute you, brother. We salute you, man.
We appreciate you. And thank you so much for joining us. We hope to see you again soon.
Brother Ellsberg, he's full of fire at 89 years young. He cares. He still cares.
A lot of passion, a lot of passion. And the young people, I think he had some great advice.
Absolutely. I was so glad you asked that question directly in terms of what does one say to young people. It was just so good to hear what he had to say.
Beautiful. But there's more resources. We're gonna share some resources with our community on this topic. We don't want people to think our episodes can be 4 hours long, so I can talk forever with you. But we have to embrace them the next time. But I want to make sure everyone knows that on our link, they'll be in the description for this episode, the conversation that Cornell West had with Julian Assange inside the Ecuadorian embassy. It's a great conversation. So click on the link in the description to this episode to be taken to that material. Thank you all for joining us for this really impassioned and heavy episode of The Tightrope with Dan Ellsberg. As always, send us questions, comments, recommendations, inquiries. We're on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and I heard we're even on TikTok. So I guess that would mean officially we're everywhere.
And you're on TikTok too. That's all right.
That's what I heard. We made it to TikTok. That's big news for our generations.
We have been.
I knew you were going to say that. Anyway, if you want to know everybody out there about future episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel and definitely join us for the next time on The Tightrope. Thanks all very much.